to the King. Hello, podcast listeners. My name is Kelly Richardson Lawson. I'm a mother, a wife, and an entrepreneur. I started the Sunrise Project after our beautiful teenage son attempted to take his own life.
Truth is, I'm tired.
My husband and I felt despair, isolation, and immeasurable pain. I knew in my heart we needed a place for Black parents to share their struggles, find mutual support, and help our beloved children who struggle with mental wellness, addiction, or both. Each weekly podcast features an expert who shares their knowledge and takes questions from parents and children.
Take me to the King. I don't have much to bring.
The Sunrise Project allows Black families, like ours, to find comfort in knowing that we are not alone. While the purpose of the Sunrise Project is to share, support, and uplift, this conversation is not a substitute for medical advice. Finding the right healthcare professional for your family's specific needs is crucial. If you do not feel seen or heard, you should speak to more than one professional to find the right fit.
Take me to the King.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for being here this morning, and welcome to our weekly parent call for the Sunrise Project. Once again, so happy you're all here this morning, and I also really, really hope that we all find a moment of solace and peace as we share this morning and learn from one another in a safe space filled with love, compassion, and a mutual desire to heal our families and ourselves. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. So with that, I'm going to introduce Dr. Julie Lopez, who is here today to talk with us about self-harm. Dr. Julie is a wonderful, incredible speaker and dear friend. This morning, Dr. Julie's subject is self-harm. And of course, most of us don't enjoy pain. We go through great lengths to avoid it. And so it is often quite shocking if we learn that our child inflicts pain on him or herself. The American Psychological Association defines self-harm or self-injury in the following way. Quote, the condition, which is clinically known as non-suicidal self-injury or NSSI, is characterized by deliberate self-inflicted harm that isn't intended to be suicidal. People who self-harm may carve or cut their skin, burn themselves, bang or punch objects or themselves, embed objects under their skin, or engage in a myriad of other behaviors that are intended to cause themselves pain, but not end their lives. According to statistics, almost 1 in 5 humans self-injures themselves in their lifetime. Dr. Julie Lopez is an amazing speaker, master clinician, and the founder of Viva Partnership, a mental health organization dedicated to sparking a mental health revolution. She is also the author of a book on implicit memory entitled Live Empowered, Rewire Your Brain's Implicit Memory to Thrive in Business, Love, and Life. This morning, Dr. Julie will speak to us about what we can do as parents to be an ally to our teens around self-injury. She will also discuss the signs, the warning signs, the causes, and strategies that we can use to reduce self-harm. So with that, I want to turn it over to Dr. Julie Lopez. Thank you so much for being here this morning with us. Again, really appreciate your time, and I will turn it over to you.
Thank you so much, Kelly, for having me, and thank you all for tuning in today especially. I want to say a little bit more about how I got into this field because it relates to self-injury and what we're going to talk about today. So my life started in trauma, and I think that trajectory then was set as I moved into my professional life. I was completely obsessed with understanding the human system, how it works, and what we can do to heal. And one of the main things I want to say today and why I think this topic is so important is that mental health is just one part of our overall wellness. I'm really on a crusade to destigmatize mental health, because one of the reasons why this isn't talked about a lot is because it has so much stigma around it. There are a lot of people who are engaging in self-harm or self-injury and don't tell anybody. And I want to first set a context for this and explain, like Kelly introduced, when someone's self-harming, self-injuring, self-mutilating, there are lots of different terms out there, they're not trying to kill themselves. And I think often, especially as parents, that's the first fear, especially if you catch someone in the act of cutting and there's maybe a lot of blood and there's obviously it's a violent act on our bodies. But really, I want to talk a little bit about our human system and how we deal with stress. Not because there's anything wrong with anybody, but we are actually conditioned and programmed to survive. So, and I talk about things on a spectrum, and self-injury itself is on a spectrum. So when we have things that are stressors in our lives, right? And here's the spectrum again, from big T trauma, like violence, neglect, natural disaster, sexual abuse, things like fire, flood, famine, things that are overtly traumatic. There's a spectrum down to kind of small T, the things that our society might not see or culturally might not recognize, but cause distress in our system, like the family that looks perfect on the outside, right, sits in the front row of church and everyone, you know, dresses the right way and looks the right way. But inside the home, there's violence or there's neglect, real busy lives where people aren't getting what they need to feel nurtured and to feel seen. I've actually had the privilege of being on a number of times, and I shared about PTSS, post-traumatic slave syndrome, which is the way that multi-generationally information that was passed down from this horrible era of incredible trauma on lots of different levels, that the lessons of survival are learned and then passed on without words, but only through behaviors, like a mom in the present day who learned that if your child got too much visibility, and this was from grandmother, great-grandmother, down the line, that it was dangerous, because that was dangerous if you had a child that excelled or drew attention to themselves that could cause violence or beatings. Not anything anyone learned in this lifetime, but was passed on as a way of survival. I use Holocaust survivor stories in the same way. You know, people in 2021 who have a war room, right, just ready to hide and to survive with food and strategies just in case, right? Nothing they learned in their lifetime, but the ideas of it and the fear around losing everything and the violence that ensued gets passed on through generations. So I just want to say first that I know Kelly mentioned my book, but implicit memory is where this unconscious part of our system is where some of that data lives. Even things like racism today that can be subtle and maybe not even identifiable, but the data keeps coming in saying you're not valued, you're not worth it, you're not going to get the same access as other people. Those types of things that look invisible, right, in the day-to-day transactions, it's not the same as a gun. They can impact the way our system feels. And our system is all of it, our emotional health, our psychological health, our spiritual health, the way that our nervous system works. We can have physical responses to this type of data. I'm sharing this. This is my area of interest. My expertise is in trauma, but it goes beyond the big trauma things that we know that are more overt. It's really about the way our human system adapts. And this feeds into self-injury, because what do we do with these types of things? What do we do when our system's overwhelmed, when our system gets the signal that we're going to die or that we're not okay or that we're in danger in some way? It does what it needs to do to adapt, to survive. It usually compartmentalizes something that's too big to metabolize, and puts it in smaller pieces and can even hide things away. It's not uncommon that someone just completely unplugs from something they've been through and doesn't act, is like, yeah, no big deal. Like, they're completely disconnected. It's called dissociation. And they do this not consciously. Our body does it. Our body does all kinds of things automatically that we don't control. Like right now, right, I'm breathing and I'm not telling my body to breathe. My lungs are moving. Blood is going through my body. You know, my food, my breakfast is being digested. All of that is happening without my command. There's no conscious direction being given to that. And it's the same with our emotional and mental health. There are things that just are being told to our system. And those types of things that help us survive are things that we call addictions, right, or compulsions. So things like drugs or alcohol, of course, are the first things people think of. But there's other stuff like eating, right? There's a whole lot we could talk about there, but eating is but obviously we need to eat in order to nurture our bodies. But sometimes food can be about soothing. Food can be about forgetting. You know, food can be about all kinds of things. Food can be about punishment. And I could go on and on with all the compulsive behaviors, obsessive compulsive disorder. I mean, that's the clinical diagnosis, but ordering and reordering your closet, getting, you know, the books in alphabetical order by date of publication, like the wiping the door handles, looking for the keys. It's all a distraction, and it's a beautiful and incredible way to give us a buffer from things that feel overwhelming. Working. I mean, I know people are chiming in from all over, but Kelly and I live in the D.C. area, DMV, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia, and it's just full of overachievers that some could say are addicted to work and the high of accomplishment. And all of these things, again, just give us a buffer. This may not seem related to self-injury yet, but it totally is. Because what I want to say about self-injury, and I appreciate Kelly sharing some stats, because I definitely want to take the stigma out of it. Think about that, almost 1 in 5. And yet, how often have you heard someone talking about self-injury? I can tell you, as a mental health professional of over 27 years in the industry, it's one of the least talked about topics, the most stigmatized. And I think it's because there's a lot of misconceptions about it. But it works the same way as the underlying purpose of any type of compulsive act, which is that our body is trying to get relief. It's trying to manage what is going on inside of it. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in detail, but I want to share a couple other stats with you. The average age of the first incident of self-harm is 13. This is according to a global study involving over 40 countries. So 13 years old, almost half of people use cutting as their method of self-injury. But it isn't just cutting. Kelly mentioned a few others. Burning, using objects to hit yourself, or throwing your body into the wall, like things like that. There are other ways of self-injuring. And half of people don't get help for it. And they're not getting help always from professionals. I usually, and this is something I'll share with you all as parents, I usually, as a therapist, will bring it up proactively, not to ask someone about it. I'll just mention it like I'm sharing some educational material, and I'm sharing it in a way that takes the stigma out of it. Like, I'll just say something, and it's not even necessarily because I've seen the signs of it, but just that I know it's correlated with people being in distress. So if someone's coming to me and we're working through a bunch of symptoms related to stress, anxiety, depression, behaviors and symptoms that I know mean that their body's been under duress, I'll just share something like, hey, some of the things you're talking about remind me of this, you know, other client I worked with, and one of the ways that he used to make himself feel better when he felt so numb that he couldn't feel anything, and he himself would start to get anxious about, you know, if he was still functioning and alive, he would, you know, take an iron and hit himself over the head. And when he got the feeling that he could actually feel something, the anxiety would totally go down. And so he was really looking for relief. And I just, some of the things that you're sharing are making me think about that client. I'll say something like that. And so it's like an invitation. It's like an invitation without saying, are you cutting yourself? Are you self-injuring? Because again, most people's knee jerk is to say no, even if they're doing it. And look, hey, here we are today. And I don't know if your children know that you go on these calls or not, but it's very easy to say something like, hey, I just heard about this topic and I had no idea that it's pretty common, you know, and that especially if someone's pretty stressed out, it's common. And I learned today that it's actually adaptive. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit more about that because, of course, and let me tell you, as someone who does a lot of supervision for other clinicians, when clinicians are first faced with a client who's self-injuring, if they haven't been exposed to the material themselves, meaning they haven't really done focused study with trauma, oftentimes the therapists themselves don't know what to do with it. And the ideal response is not to be too freaked out about it. And I know that's super hard when you're a parent and you want all good things for your child, and that certainly doesn't involve hurting themselves or what looks like hurting themselves in some way. So we're going to talk a little bit more about that as we go on. But what does that look like? First of all, I want to say people self-injure for different reasons. Everyone who's cutting, everyone who's, you know, hurting themselves in some way is not doing it for the same reasons. So when I'm working with someone, I'm first asking them, like I do with any addiction, with any compulsion, I ask them what they are getting out of it. Not in any way of contempt or disdain or sarcasm or anything, but because I know they're doing it, because it's, take this with a grain of salt, it's good for their system in some way. It's giving them relief. It's helping them do something consciously or unconsciously that's working for them. So here are some of the things I've heard over the last three decades. Like I said, that with that one particular, that actually is a client that I worked with. When I shared the story, he couldn't feel. He just would start freaking out because he couldn't feel things. He felt super numb and felt like he wasn't even like a person on the planet. And so what he was getting out of the self-injury was that the pain was taking the anxiety down significantly. So it wasn't, so he was hurting himself, but the hurt was allowing him to feel more alive because he was more concerned that he was completely dead inside. And so he was getting relief around feeling more alive. For some people, it's that they can't express all the words don't work to express what they're feeling. And so when they see the cut or when they see the blood, it, in a visual and sensory way, scratches that itch. The same way a drink or drugs or food or gambling or work or can, right? When it's a compulsion, there's something else at play. It's not that, you know, I want to spend all night gambling. It's that I'm looking for the hit. Everyone's looking for a hit. And I would argue, after working with so many people on addictions, that the hit is actually serving a higher purpose. And this becomes important in terms of what you can do or what the treatment looks like for someone who's self-injuring. So when someone's self-injuring, they're always looking for relief, and the relief comes in the form of sensory input. And what do I mean by that? It's a visual, like I said, the blood. It's tactile, the pain. It's auditory, the slam, right, against the wall. It can be olfactory, the burn, right? The smell of it. And something about the sense, the sensation helps their system calm down and gives them the hit that they're looking for. And again, the hit might be different. The same way when someone struggles with drugs or alcohol, the chemical addictions, right? I can line 10 people up in a room. And for someone, if I say, hey, what do you like about it? And actually, let me just say, because drugs and alcohol are so stigmatized as an addiction in our culture, most of the times when I first ask that, they're like, no, it's bad. It's ruining my life. They'll give the canned answer that society's told them is what drugs and alcohol are about, destroying lives and all this stuff. But underneath it, there's something that's working. So people will say, one person might say, it makes me feel like everything's going to be okay. So that's about safety, security. It makes me feel like I can do anything, like no obstacles in my way. That's about power and control. It makes me feel like I have options, like no matter what happens, I'm going to find my way out. That's about freedom. All these things, power, freedom, safety, and there's more. Like I said, 10 people in a room, it could all be different. Those are good things. Those are things that every human being wants to feel. Well, it's the same kind of stuff with self-injury. Most people, therapists, family members, friends, want the self-injury to stop. If the self-injury is going to stop, really stop, there's got to be other ways to get the feeling, to get the sensation that's giving them relief. So a part of that is looking for how to have the sight, smell, sound in a less harmful way until it's something that they actually feel within themselves while they're working in treatment. And those examples I gave were power, freedom, safety, right? Feeling like I'm going to be okay and that I'm safe is a really important feeling. So for someone who's self-injuring, what we'll do in treatment is actually look for things that give them that. If it's the color of blood, we might try to substitute a marker on the legs, right? If it's pain, we might, and I'm overly simplifying this because ideally we custom tailor it to each person. We might use a rubber band and flick it up on there, you know, suggest these different things. I'm not saying that I would do it to them, but we're looking to build the tool house. And just like a suicide contract, because a lot of times people don't want to do it. They just want the relief that's coming from it. So usually clients are pretty open to, especially if you're talking about it in a non-shaming way, right? That this is normal. A lot of people do it. You're not alone. It's so great we're talking about it. Thank you for sharing this part of your life with me, because I'm telling you, if you say to your child, are you self-injuring? Most of them are going to say no, whether they're doing it or not. It has to be presented in a way where it feels like an invitation that someone can take whenever they're ready for it, and that they get the vibe that you're not going to freak out about it, right? And that can be super hard, which is a lot of times if our kids are struggling, why we need support too, why something like this is so important. So yeah, flicking rubber band, maybe an ice cube, right? That's a sensory experience. Ah, so cold, really hot shower. Ah, so hot. So there's some pain involved, but it's not excessive, right? So we might make a plan that has five options on it, and the fifth one, and you start with one, and the fifth one would be what has been effective. So it would actually include whatever method of self-injury they've been engaging in, and that's what takes the stigma out of it too. It's like, I get it, this is important for you, it also has risk factors to it, and your system needs the relief that it's looking for. And so we're going to give some other options to dial it down. I know that when we talked about doing this particular segment, there was interest in, like, how do I know? How am I going to know if my child is doing this? Especially, like I said, if this is one of the most stigmatized aspects of mental health. I know this isn't the answer you're going to want to hear, but you're probably not going to know. You're probably not going to know if they're engaging in this, because people usually work pretty hard to hide it. But there are signs, right? You can see scarring if people are cutting. You can see burn marks. The important thing, I think, as a parent, when you see signs or you hear something, is not to ignore it, is not to act like it's not happening. But the way you engage, and again, you may need support around this, the more accepting you can be, the more normalizing you can be, the more likely they're going to see you as an ally who they can talk to. And trust me, as an adolescent, parents aren't always seen as allies. This is developmentally appropriate, right? As teenagers, our kids are supposed to be finding their own identity. They're supposed to be kind of rebelling and stepping out. But the hard part is most of their friends don't know this information, aren't really going to have the answers for them. And sometimes if someone's really hurting, and this is real, someone may actually learn about self-injury from someone else that's doing it as a way of coping. So, you know, all the more important to be kind of present with our kids, to share with them about how this works, and that there's a way to work through it without having to give it up, right? Because one of the main reasons, not only the shame and the stigma, is it's working for them. So there's a fear that if I share this, there's going to be all this effort and energy to try to take this away from me. I'm going to share another resource that, so I own a center in the middle of DC, and we're all.
Before you do that, you mentioned something that I'd love you just to explain, which was suicide contract, I think you said, or agreement. Can you explain
what
that is? And then also, you also commented about, you know, staying, like communicating. How could a parent, give some examples of how a parent would do that if they first found out their child was self-harming? What would be some suggested language?
Yeah, and what I was going to share was about the Resilient Brain Project.
Okay,
because there's great stuff. There's great stuff in there for allies, because one of the things is, I'll give some language, but everyone's different. So self-injury is different by person also. I know I've mentioned that a few times. So the first thing is, I guess one of the scenarios is that you hear something, right? You hear banging noises, or you hear something and you wonder what's happening, right? And you know your child's in their room by themselves. So you come in and you just say, hey, I hope you don't mind. I'm going to use your son's name as an example, just because you've been taught. I know you're super upfront about. Yep. So you say, hey, Kyle, I just heard a lot of noise and wanted to check in on what's going on. Oh, it's nothing. My books fell off the thing. Okay. You know, this may just be me, but it sounded like you were involved in the noise, like that maybe if books fell, maybe they fell on you. But I just wanted to tell you a little bit about what I heard about last week. And it was about self-injury. And if, you know, and like there were a bunch of stories, and I know that you said it was just the books that fell, but it sounds like it's pretty common, and it's a normal way that our body works to try to get relief. And so I just want you to know, if that's what's happening, like, I'm cool to talk to about that. And, you know, I want to be on your team. Yeah, whatever, Mom, you know, blah, blah, blah. Something like that. That's how it would look. Because more than anything, they're going to vibe off the fact that you're not freaking out. Even if you're freaking out inside, and it makes it more possible than for a future conversation. Like, you can come to me and like, I'm not going to freak out about it. And it was kind of cool because we learned about different ways that it can actually be helpful for someone. And that, like, if they ever want to, you know, to stop doing it, there's actually a path to do it. And you're just planting a seed, because they're not going to, you know, you're not going to say some miracle sentence and they're going to be like, great, come on in, let's talk. You know, that was 10 years old, right? 17 years old, 18, 19, 20, 21, it's not going to look like that. So it's just, hey, I just want to share, and the vibe that I want to impart on you is that I am not going to be one of those people that rushes you to the hospital or that starts crying and gets all freaked out. And trust me, this is hard. This is super hard, but that's the type of tone, and the tone itself and bringing up the subject says there's like a meta communication going on that says, I'm a safe person for you to talk to. And when they get to that point, or when there's that moment where maybe they want to stop or they're concerned about it, the fact that you were calm about it and then you said, hey, there's a path through it, makes you a resource for them. So that was the one. Your other question. So a suicide contract is something that we do in the therapy room. And it's when, you know, we're mandated reporters. You all can report anytime, but we have to report if we suspect that suicide is imminent. And so we can require with clients to set up a contract. And what does that look like? It looks like an agreement about what the person is going to do if they start to feel like they don't want to live, or they start to feel really distressed, or they start to feel like the only way out is to end their life, or that there's no hope for feeling relief from their overwhelming feelings. And it basically is written in paragraph form. It's not long, but it's basically, I agree to, and then there's usually bullet points around what they agree to do before killing themselves. One of them always involves, for my clients, calling me. So that would be on the list, but it might be because we'd be working together on building the stress tolerance. So there's probably tools that we've already identified that help them calm down, right? Again, every person's different. So to give an example, let's just say for one particular client, it might be, I'm going to listen to this song, right, that I know like calms me down. I'm going to smell these essential oils because that works for me. I'm going to reach out to my best friend or my safe person because I know they're good to talk to. I'm going to call the suicide hotline. I'm going to call you. I'm going to go to the emergency room. And then, you know, and they sign it, something like that. So there's a progression that they carry with them that they've agreed contractually with me to follow. You can do the same thing if they're willing. Kind of depends on the relationship and the situation by person. But that's what a suicide contract looks like in terms of agreement when they start to feel overwhelmed. Most people in the long term don't actually want to die. Again, when there's a successful suicide or an attempted suicide, they usually want relief from pain and they're not seeing a way out in the moment. And so the things on the list are usually to reduce the stress tolerance and to let other people in that can kind of help through that tough moment.
Great. Thank you for that. Super helpful.
No problem. And I know we're at about the time that you like to open up for Q&A or for people to share, get input on their situation. So I'm just mindful of the time right now.
That's perfect. And you're right. Would love to open it up for questions or comments from anybody on the phone. And there is a question. Please share some thoughts for those children who learn about SH from peers and decide to try it and keep doing it.
It's all the same. If they hear from peers about it and they try it and they keep doing it, they're only continuing to do it because it's working for them, right? If they learn from peers and it doesn't work, they're not going to continue. And that's the same with any type of coping mechanism. If it sticks, if it works, they're going to continue. So it's really a time to slow down if they'll talk to you about it and ask questions that, and this is true, even when someone's in a therapy room with me, they're very surprised by the question, like, what do you get out of it? Or what do you like about it? That is not the question they expect to hear, especially not from a parent, right? So I would say, slow it down. If you find out your child's cutting and they found out from their friend and they're continuing to do it, I would just ask, hey, so what do you, how is that working for you? And they're like, well, it's kind of embarrassing. I don't want people to see my arms. Or they'll say something first that's against it. You say, no, but like what, obviously you learned about it and you tried it and then you liked it and you've continued doing it. So it must be helping you with something. Like, what does it help you with? And then you can hear what it is. Do they feel numb? Do they feel overwhelmed? Do they feel pain that they can't express in words? And this allows them to actually really, in a way, be attuned to themselves. It's giving them an effective outlet. And that's where the conversation starts. And then you can start, so I didn't get to finish. So www.resilientbrainproject.com is a free online resource. And it's huge. It's got all kinds of information in there, here and now information about how to change a felt state, but also every overarching mental health topic, which we have 12 of them, including a crisis section, has four allies. So you're an ally in this situation. You are an affirming witness and a loving family member and someone who wants all best things for your child. So you are an ally, and there's pointers on how to communicate, how to speak to someone who's struggling with all kinds of different mental health things. One of the struggles when we ourselves don't know much about what's happening or it's being introduced, or, you know, we're a parent, so we have all the normal reactions to what's going on. I know what I'm saying to you is extremely hard. The natural first reaction is to freak out and to be so worried and upset. And so it gives language that helps to make clear what types of things would be better received by the person who's so anxious. Like that's a good one to give an example. Like someone's so anxious and you telling them to just calm down is 100% the wrong thing to say. Although it may have come from great intentions of wanting, you know, you see your child all worked up and freaking out about something and you want them to calm down. So you tell them to calm down and it literally jacks the anxiety up higher. So it's stuff like that, like the natural things aren't always the things that help someone feel seen or feel welcomed to communicate. So because this is so stigmatized, the best thing you can do is practice that. Find your resources, like this call, like your friends, like the people that really see you where you can freak out. And then with your child, like be the container, be the person that's saying, I'm a safe person for you to talk to, right? This is, you know, this is something that happens for people. It happens quite commonly. Mm-hmm. It's a distress management tool, and that's okay. And I want to hear you. And believe it or not, that's a part of the intervention, right? Just hearing whatever is going on or inviting them to be curious, like what are you getting out of it, it means that you're attuned to them or you're standing in the posture of attunement. And they're going to feel that. Even if that's all the direction that the conversation goes in.
That's so powerful, standing in the power of attunement. I've never heard it said like that. I think that's so powerful because you're right. We tend to go, oh my God, run to the emergency room, you know, which is immediately the opposite of what you're saying to do.
That's yeah.
Really powerful, really helpful. There are a couple more questions in the chat, but please finish your thought.
Each one of these things that I gave as an example is basically the person trying to attune to themselves. So it just says more about that move to be attuned to them.
I love it. Okay, there's a person has asked this question. Is there an alternative to calling it self-harm? If the child is getting release, if their anxiety is being lowered, isn't it gaslighting to call it self-harm? And isn't that harmful when you approach it like that?
Yeah, and it's a good question. And frankly, that's the way my whole center has been built, is that this is a normal way that our bodies respond. I even tell my clients, look, we've got this big manual called the DSM, right, where we give these labels and we give clients the option, but insurance sure does need that code if they're going to pay for what's happening. But it's a whole system of pathologizing normal behaviors. I for clinicians, for many years, I did a whole training series on depathologizing trauma, right? And I would give all the diagnostic codes, and then I'd explain why it was normal from a trauma-informed perspective. So yeah, that's a great question. These are the labels that have been put on it to describe what's happening, because in fact, the person is self-harming. It's undeniable that when you cut yourself and see blood, that there's harm that's happening, but there's a bigger story there, right? There's a bigger story. So gaslighting is a term that is about saying something is something when it's not happening at all. So self-injury is happening, and I think it would also be more compassionate and fine to also speak to the other part of the whole story, which is, hey, I understand that sometimes you might do things that are giving you the ability to feel stronger or that are helping you express the pain that you're in. Because trust me, the pain that they feel by cutting themselves is nothing compared to the mess that's inside. They're getting a little relief by showing some of it, right? And so that is an adaptive approach. And I think it's fine to call it whatever you want related to the different components that are present. And I think the question was really a good one, because in the move to make space and to create bridges and to make conversation, I think highlighting the parts that are the deeper meanings behind it are going to be an invitation for conversation and connection and ultimately healing.
That's really fantastic. Thank you. Feedback. That feedback is awesome. There's another question in the chat that says, is self-harm more prevalent in girls versus boys?
So here's the interesting thing. Even with that study, we don't know the actual numbers, because keep in mind, a lot of people don't report it. You know, I think that in mental health in general, historically, females have been more open about struggles with mental health than men. So it gets really complicated. It gets really complicated fast when we're talking about statistics. So I think right now the statistics do show that women tend towards self-harm strategies in terms of managing mental health. But my particular bias is that it's very underreported overall, and especially underreported in men.
Got it. Thank you. Is there any, here's one other question. Does separating our child from their friends help? Are we able to choose our kids' friends?
Oh boy. I'm a parent too, and I've got four teenagers. So I don't know, you know, kids, especially if they're struggling, and there's the dynamics, like I said, developmentally around, like, this is my life, I want to run my life, like, I'm my own person. I think once we get to teenage years, it's extremely hard to do that. And one of the realities, this is like a psych 101 reality, that, like, what you resist will persist. You know, the more that something's taboo, the more enticing it is, especially when you're in a developmental phase where rebellion is part of the growth trajectory for everyone, right? For everyone. So I think our influence goes down more and more as the children get older. And I think we could all talk about that one together, just as a mom. It's hard. That is really hard.
I think the what you resist, they persist is huge, huge, huge. So right on. There's another comment in the chat that I'd like to read. It says, this is so important. My daughter is a cutter. This is a difficult question to frame, but if it is about seeking that release or for expression of feeling, if she isn't getting that release she seeks, is it possible for the cutting to escalate into something more harmful or something that will hurt her even more?
Yeah. So again, each person's different. So what particular role it's playing is going to be different by person. So I'm just going to speak in generalities. The most common misconception when someone's self-injuring is that it is a suicide attempt, or that it's on the way to suicide. That is not true, but there is some correlation, because people self-injure for different reasons. And so if the reason that someone's self-injuring is because of unresolved trauma, right, there may be some correlation to suicidality because of all of the other things that they're negotiating and the other pain that they might be in. It's not a direct one-to-one type of ratio, like this is the precursor to suicide, but there is some correlation. I didn't mention that earlier. But the bigger thing is that there's a way to work with it, and there's a way to figure out kind of what that map is in your body and to be able to work with it, to figure out how to have other adaptations that allow your body to get what it needs. So I hope that's helpful.
Great. I want to just say thank you so much, Dr. Julie, for being here today. I know I've learned so many things. I wish I had known some of these things a few years ago, but I will take them forward, and hope to get the word out with our village. So appreciate you for being here and sharing such great insight on this issue. And maybe I shouldn't call it issue, on this situation. and helping us as parents know how to really focus on the relationship and the conversation instead of jumping to, you know, fear and not opening that space for conversation. So thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate you again. So thank you.
And thanks for having me, Kelly.
Of course. Turning it over to Kelly Chapman now for our closing prayer.
Okay. And yes, Dr. Julie, thank you so much. I have a couple of friends who have children with this situation, and this has been very insightful for me, so I appreciate it. Today, we give thanks for Dr. Julie Lopez, who gave us a better understanding of when and why our children may inflict harm upon themselves. We love our children, and we want to better understand them. Lord, thank you for the opportunity to gain insights about this common situation. Help us to unpack the trauma in our child's lives and understand their survival strategy, a disassociation. We learned today that self-injury is a way of getting relief. We learned that 1 in 5 people self-injures. God, knowing how prevalent this is, give us a heightened awareness of what may happen behind closed doors with our loved ones. Give us the words to start a dialogue that makes them feel loved and secure enough to open up to us. And Lord, when our child feels trapped and unable to express their feelings into words, we pray a hedge of protection around them right now. Lord, encircle them with aha moments where they find new ways to feel and to be safe. Whatever gives them relief without harm, God, we ask you to send it. As parents and caregivers, if there is something we can do in the moment, give us the awareness to be there so that they feel welcome to engage with us for support. Give us the ability to not cause alarm with our children. Help us to be your light and your vessel, guiding them to gently want to first talk with us about what they are doing and for us to feel like we are on their team. So we thank you in advance for your guidance and your love. In your name we pray, amen.
Amen. Thank you, Kelly, for that. As always, incredible. Thank you all for being here this week, and we'll be back next week.
I'm Kelly Richardson Lawson, and you've been listening to the Sunrise Project podcast. You can follow Sunrise wherever you listen to podcasts. If you haven't yet, open your podcast app and follow this show. Join us next week for another gathering of support. Thank you for listening. If you or someone you know is struggling with mental wellness challenges, contact your doctor, NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or both. You can reach NAMI's helpline at 800-950-6264, Monday through Friday, 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Time, or email at info@nami.org. Volunteers are working to answer questions, offer support, and provide practical next steps.